Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in the American South. I'm your host, Brandon Jett. On today's podcast, I'm speaking with Dr. Virginia L. Soumy, a historian and co-founder of The Source Historical Consulting. Her research focuses on North Carolina history, political and legal history, African American history, and women's history. Today, we're talking about her recent book, The Life of Elreta Melton Alexander, Activism Within the Courts, published by the University of Georgia Press in 2022. As the title suggests, this book explores the life and contributions of a groundbreaking attorney and judge, Elreta Melton Alexander Ralston. Her life and career deserve recognition for several reasons, including an impressive list of firsts, but also owing to her accomplishments during the civil rights movement in the U.S. South. While Alexander did not actively participate in civil rights marches and demonstrations, she used her professional achievements and middle-class status to advocate for individuals who lacked a voice in the Southern legal system. Soumy argues that Alexander was integral to the civil rights movement in North Carolina, as she and women like her worked to change discriminatory laws while opening professional doors for other minority women. Dr. Soumy, welcome to New Books in the American South.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
Well, first and foremost, congratulations on the book. I know that is no small feat, so I was really excited to see this out at the SHA most recently, which was really, really cool.
Yes, I was. Oh, that's so exciting when you get to a conference and you get to see your book in person there.
It's like it's real.
It is.
It exists in the flesh. Well, before we delve in too far to the life of Elreta and her larger legacy, I was hoping you could give us an idea of your own background and how you came across this incredibly accomplished, but at least to my understanding, largely unknown figure from North Carolina history.
Right. I'm a native North Carolinian, born and raised. My father was a United Methodist minister, so we lived all over Western North Carolina. And I went to high school and did my undergraduate work in Salisbury, North Carolina, which is about 45 minutes southwest of Greensboro. After I graduated from Catawba College, I did an AmeriCorps VISTA project in Montana, where I stayed for 8 years and ended up getting my master's degree in history at the University of Montana. And so I was in a class with my mentor, Anya Jabbour, called Writing Women's Lives. And I thought, well, geez, it'd be really cool to write about somebody from North Carolina. And I'm digging around and I'm not really coming up with anything. And I think I was on the North Carolina History Museum website and I saw a timeline.
I was actually just going to ask you, where were you digging around from Montana
exactly.
In North Carolina history?
But... just sitting on the couch in my little studio apartment in Missoula. And I saw 1968, Elreta Melton Alexander becomes the first Black female district court judge in the country. And I was like, wow, I've never heard of this person before. And it really snowballed from there. And I was surprised how many people, particularly of my generation, I'm 40. So, you know, people who were born just immediately after her career ended had never heard of her before. Mm-hmm. My husband was born and raised in Greensboro and had never heard of her, but my father-in-law knew her. And so it was really interesting to dive into her life and also learn so much about the city of Greensboro. Mm-hmm. And the work prompted me to apply to get my PhD at UNC Greensboro. So then I was... paper that I was writing turned into my master's thesis, which ended up bringing me back home. I always say, oh, Rita brought me back home and moved to Greensboro to write the dissertation.
That's really cool. I had a mentor a long time ago once tell me we're all, as historians, just destined to write about where we're from. Like, that's really what we're looking at, just trying to figure out, where are we from? What does this all mean? And it seems like in many ways, your path has kind of brought you back to studying about where you're from.
Exactly. And I learned so much about where I was from. I was a political science major at Catawba College. Yeah. I minored in history and took classes on Southern political history. And while I had the most amazing political science advisor at Catawba, there were things that I learned in researching this book that, I had never heard of before.
Yeah, that's really cool. Well, okay, maybe I'm off on this. So if I am, feel free to tell me. But I feel like biography is kind of downplayed a little bit in graduate school, right? Like it's a tougher sell to come in and say, hey, I want to write a dissertation about this one person, right? I'm going to write a biography. I feel like that's kind of fallen out of favor, even though I think biography in many ways are like the most engaging kinds of historical work. And it's what I think popular audiences are kind of drawn to historical figures and they want to learn more about them. So I wonder, what was it about her story that made you think, hey, this deserves to be kind of explored in a book-length project and not just a one-off, paper for a graduate class?
Right. Well, I was definitely discouraged from doing a dissertation as a biography. First of all, I was just got really lucky that when the initial person I wanted to work with at UNCG was like, no. And so fortunately, Chuck Bolton, who was the head of the history department there, took me on as an advisee. And he had just written a biography on William Winter, who was a former governor of Mississippi. So he was more than happy to, well, I hope he was more than happy to take me on, and was really great about advising me on how to turn this dissertation into a publishable biography. But when it came to just talking about Elrita herself or Judge Alexander herself, it was just the amount of historiography that I had to cover within a biography was appealing to me because, like you said, there was that home aspect of it. But even in going and being a civil rights historian, her story is so unique and her approaches to activism are so unique. And I really found it so fascinating that, at the beginning when I was studying about her and she would walk up to these white judges and say, well, I'm just going to go see what the difference is between this white water and this colored water and just go drink from the white water fountain. And I'm sitting there thinking, who does that?
Right.
And so the more I got to know about her life professionally, and then also everything that she had to overcome personally as well, which is, I mean, her personal life was pretty rough.
Yeah, and absolutely.
So I thought, well, this could easily be an interesting biography. If not, probably won't be a bestseller, but it would definitely be interesting and I think have a lot of local appeal. So far, it's been pretty well received in Greensboro.
Oh, I can only imagine. And I will say it is incredibly appealing, even to someone who's never been to Greensboro and only visited North Carolina once for like a short weekend. So I think you've done a fantastic job of demonstrating this isn't just about one person, which, obviously all biographies are, but it also tells larger stories about the civil rights movement, the Jim Crow era, and the post-civil rights movement in the South in really engaging and personable ways. So I think you've done a really fantastic job.
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, I say Greensboro is kind of a secondary character in the book because Greensboro is known for being a civil rights city. Mm-hmm. It's known for the ANT4. But most people don't even know the stories about the Bennett Bells behind the ANT4 and George Simpkins and Elrita Alexander and all of these stories that make Greensboro civil rights history so nuanced.
Absolutely. Okay, so let's get into her life a little bit. She eventually becomes a respected lawyer and judge in North Carolina, and she is a Black woman who, even though she would be reluctant to admit it, was a pioneer in many, many respects. Yet you make the case, as with all good biographies, that her childhood really laid the foundation for her future work and activism, even if she wouldn't call it that. So what was her childhood like, and how do you think it related to what comes in her future as a lawyer and reluctant pioneer, as you claim? Or I guess as she claimed, right?
As she claimed, yeah. So her childhood was, she grew up a part of what we would think of as the Black middle class. Her father was a graduate of Shaw University, which is the oldest HBCU in the South. And Shaw was really a school that really pumped out ministers and educators. And her father was a Baptist minister. And so they moved around, but so she didn't land in Greensboro until she was about 12 years old. But she comes from this educated, Du Boisian, talented 10th type setting. And so her father said that, you know, nobody would be allowed to sleep under his roof without a college degree. Mm-hmm. And so there was just basic expectations of her and her siblings, like, you will get a college degree. That is not a question, that laid the groundwork, you know, for her future career. Should also be noted that her sister also became an attorney as well, in Zanesville, Ohio, and mm-hmm. her oldest brother became a respected educator in North Carolina. So all three of them were very professionally successful people, mm-hmm. largely because of the emphasis on education that her father placed on them early in life.
Yeah, and it seems like there's something to not only being a member of the Black middle class, but also the children of the town minister, right? That like adds another element to how she develops throughout her childhood and how she kind of understands what her role maybe is and will become later in life. Do you think there's, I mean, am I making this up, or do you think there's some connection between the idea of being a minister's daughter that adds something to it?
I will say that is where I related to her the most, being a minister's daughter. Yes. And so, well, in that situation, and I'm talking, you know, obviously about her, but also a little bit from personal experience.
Sure.
You grow up kind of in like a small fishbowl. And people are looking at you and people are expecting you to behave in very certain ways. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't very good at it, but but it gave her a good, I guess, kind of template for her future public life, mm-hmm. as in, especially when her relationship problems started to surface, you know, how was she going to handle this publicly? And how was she going to put a public face on her career? And so I think, yeah, having those expectations put on her early in life also helped.
Absolutely. Okay, so Alexander, one of her many firsts, became the first African-American woman admitted to Columbia Law School, which is in and of itself really, really important. And I think that's why many people are probably going to be drawn to her initially. It's like, look at all these first steps that she made. But I just loved how you talked about her decision to attend Columbia Law School. So I was hoping you could maybe explain where this idea to attend law school, become a lawyer, comes from for Elrita, who had gone to college. You know, it was the expectation of her parents and her siblings that they all go to college. And then she kind of steps back for a moment, but then decides to go pursue this career. So I was hoping you could maybe kind of explain that to us, because it's a really fascinating story in and of itself.
Yeah, after college, she does what a lot of young Black women of her class do, and she goes and she becomes a teacher. But she also elopes with her college sweetheart, which quickly turns pretty sour. Actually, there were a lot of warning signs before she got married, but quickly devolves into a pretty verbally, emotionally, and physically abusive relationship. And so at the time, her husband was in medical school at Meharry Medical School in Nashville, Tennessee, which was the only medical school, at least in the South, that would accept Black med students. And so when he comes back to Greensboro and he's a surgeon, and I can't remember exactly how she phrases it, but he wasn't a sniffling little boy anymore and had, and had money and other women who were interested in him.
Which kind of wasn't his persona in college.
No, he was kind of like this shy, nerdy guy in college, and then comes back and he's like, hey, I'm a surgeon that's, you know, making more money than anybody else in the neighborhood. And so she had been volunteering. She had worked in the North Carolina A&T library, and somebody told her that she'd make a good attorney. And I think she kind of laughed it off initially. And then her husband's like, go, I'll be glad. Just, you know, stay at my mom's house. His mother lived, where does she live? I want to say she lived in Brooklyn. But not too terribly far from Columbia. And so she went up there and moved with her mother-in-law and said, well, her quote was, that bastard, I'm going to make him pay. And applied to the most expensive law schools in New York and happened to get accepted at Columbia. So yeah, this, you know, path-breaking career started as kind of vengeance.
And I also just think it kind of speaks to what comes later on in her life, where she is the first in many regards, but it's not necessarily like that, at least based on my reading, was like her main motivating factor. She didn't apply to Columbia Law School to become the first African-American woman to graduate from there. It was kind of out of spite, which I think is really, really fascinating. And it makes for a really great story, I'm sure, when you're talking to people in Greensboro about this. But despite the fact that she chose to pursue a law degree at Columbia, maybe out of spite, when she's there, she takes it very seriously. But she's also exposed to race and racism in new ways. In many ways, this was one of her first experiences outside of the Jim Crow South. So what were her experiences like as a Black woman, a kind of pioneering Black woman in New York City?
Yeah, so she grew up in Greensboro. She grew up in East Greensboro, which even today, Greensboro is a residentially very segregated city. And so she grew up in an environment where she didn't have to encounter really all that many white people. And of course, Greensboro, East Greensboro has two HBCUs. So she didn't even have to encounter, you know, white people are leaving Greensboro to get a good education. And so her, it's important to note that she was biracial. Both of her parents were biracial. She had two white grandfathers. Which was common. Her parents were both from the Great Dismal Swamp area of North Carolina, where you have a lot of bi and triracial people. And so it was her first experience where she had ever really thought about the concept of passing, because she realized that she could walk down the street on Broadway and people would assume she had some ethnicity other than Caucasian, but they didn't necessarily say, oh, there's a Black woman walking down the street. Where if she was with her, particularly her friend Herman Taylor, who was a darker skinned Black law student, he could not have the same privileges that she did. And so it was a conscious decision on her point at that particular point in her life to embrace her Blackness and say, look, I am a Black woman. I'm a product of the Jim Crow South, and you are going to accept me as I am, or you're not. And so I think it was really a good, it was her first lesson in, I mean, of course she knew about, you know, the nuances of race, but again, even in East Greensboro, she was fairly sheltered from a lot of that as well. Her father would not let her patronize segregated businesses. And so she didn't have a whole lot of experience with that before getting to Columbia, before getting outside of the South.
Yeah. And I found it interesting that you know, she could pass, as they would call it, but kind of makes a conscious decision not to, in many respects. And I think that that kind of speaks volumes to who she was as an individual. And, you know, this is a time when, you know, even being Black in the North, as she finds out, is not necessarily accepted on completely equal terms. And so I think that that really speaks to her own kind of fortitude to kind of embrace that aspect of who she is in a way that that could really lead to significant forms of discrimination, even in a place like New York City. But she eventually graduates law school. She spends a little bit of time in New York after that. But in 1947, she came back to North Carolina and yet again becomes a pioneer as the first African-American woman to practice law in the state. So this is 1947. We are coming out of World War II, but this is still the Jim Crow South. The civil rights movement of the 1950s and 1960s hasn't quite begun just yet. So here she is, the first Black woman to become a lawyer in the state. What are her experiences like when she comes back to North Carolina in 1947?
Well, there were laws set up to prevent Black people from being able to pass the bar, particularly in southern states. I believe it was Georgia that was called like the graveyard of Black lawyers or something like that, because it was just impossible for a Black person to be able to sit for the bar. Mm-hmm. And North Carolina made it extremely hard. She had to have affidavits saying that she was exceptionally meritorious just to be able to sit for the bar. And so it took it took a lot of personal issues that had happened. She had a personal setback. She was injured in a house fire. And then having to use connections within her community to be able to get to the right people to who let her sit for the bar. So a former church member of her father's worked for a local head of the Democratic Party who was having the governor of North Carolina over for dinner. Mm-hmm. And ultimately getting that word in with the governor of North Carolina was why it was helped her be able to sit for the North Carolina bar. But she also had affidavits from, you know, the dean of Columbia's law school as well. So she had to get, you know, the most powerful, you know, really white people involved in order just to be able to sit for the bar.
Yeah, yeah. And you suggest that during this period, so she passes the bar exam and becomes an attorney. And you suggest that throughout her legal career as an attorney, she developed what you call her judicial philosophy and unique style of performance activism. And this is really where I think, I don't want to put words into your mouth, you argue that she like made her mark and this kind of performative style of activism and through her philosophy. So would you just explain what those two things were? What was her legal philosophy as an attorney? And explain what performative activism looked like for Elrita.
Well, her legal philosophy was one that, you know, she was going to, and this also talks about her activism as well, but she was one who worked within the confines of the law to be able to make the law applicable to all people. And sometimes she would do that through these very theatrical performances in the courtroom. So, for instance, I mentioned the water fountain anecdote, but there was an incident in a courtroom in, I believe it was in Eastern North Carolina, where she tried to try her case from the segregated section of the courtroom. And the judge has to be like, no, Lawyer Alexander, you need to come down and stand in front of the bench. And she said, I am following the letter of the law. This is where my people are required to sit. This is where I'm going to be. And so so she really used performance to highlight the hypocrisy of segregation and how ridiculous it was. And of course, it was those type of anecdotes that really drew me into her as well, as like, this woman's awesome. And the use of theater as a form of activism, I thought was really interesting and unique. Of course, you know, theater has been always in some way used as a method of activism, but she, the way she took it and applied it to courtrooms, I thought was really interesting and creative. And if I can say ballsy, that she did that.
Yeah. And, you know, as I was thinking, as you were talking, she becomes the first Black female attorney in North Carolina. And as an attorney, she doesn't just do civil rights work, right? Like, that's not her approach. And you can talk more about that in just a moment if you'd like. But in many ways, it is her performance as a lawyer in that courtroom that is also part and parcel of civil rights activism. She is breaking down barriers, calling out hypocrisy where she sees it, and making real change within the confines of these kind of Jim Crow structures that are placed around her. So there's a couple of important cases that come up that are perhaps more civil rights focused. So I was hoping you could maybe talk to us about the kinds of cases that she took up, because they really were wide ranging. And then hopefully delve into perhaps one of the more consequential cases that she takes up, which is a 1964 case involving an interracial rape accusation. So could you just give us an idea of like the breadth of cases that she took under her belt? And then maybe we can focus a little bit more on that more clearly civil rights associated case from 1964.
Right. Well, because she was a Black attorney and she was in East Greensboro, most of her clients came from that community. Mm-hmm. But she took on child support cases where, she found out that Black women received less child support than white women. And she said, well, wait a minute, diapers aren't cheaper for Black women. Right. This is ridiculous. But also she took up, you know, a lot of landlord tenant disputes, basic things that go to, you know, the heart of, you know, how of survival. But also where there were institutional barriers that made that survival harder for African Americans. And so she said, one of her quotes was, you know, to me, every case I took up was a civil rights case because it was directly dealing with the survival of people in her community.
Yeah.
And so, so when she got to the 64 Yo's case, she was a little reluctant.
I can imagine. So can you just kind of set this scenario up for this pretty consequential and controversial case from 1964?
Yes. So there was outside of Greensboro, there's a small town called Jamestown, and there was an old, I guess, rundown mansion in the woods where teenagers would go and have sex in the back of their cars and get drunk and do all the things.
Do what teenagers do, you know?
Yes. And so ultimately, long story short, four young Black men had been there and a white couple. And the four Black men were accused of raping the white woman and beating her partner, the person that she was with. And so in 1964, so this happened in summer of 1964. The trial was starting in fall of 1964. In between the rape and the trial, Johnson signs the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which infuriates people across the South and, you know, sets into or continues, really pushes that, you know, what political historians call that great white political switch.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, people in Greensboro are in North Carolina are pretty angry. And so it ended up being a death penalty case. So these four men were subject to the death penalty. The judge said that they would be tried as a unit instead of individually. And the local Guilford County sheriff, Greensboro is in Guilford County, put... I guess you could say obstacles in the way. There were orders to shoot any of the defendants that moved during the trial and shoot that attorney as well. Mm-hmm. But also he bugged their jail cells, trying to, you know, catch them on on tape confessing, and there was also credible witness or jury tampering as well. And so it was, you know, quite the uphill battle. But of course, she was also facing her own death threats for taking on this case. But she finds that she uncovers the race-based jury selection procedures in Guilford County, which were very convoluted. And so, but ultimately, it ends up being the longest jury selection process in Guilford County up to that point. And she is successful in getting one Black male juror, and which ultimately ends up saving their lives. They are found guilty, but it's the one Black juror who recommends mercy.
Yeah, and this is one of the ways that I think you demonstrate that she had real impact through her activism on civil rights in North Carolina and breaking down some of those barriers, even if it's on a local level, to kind of including African Americans in jury selection and not allowing them to be eliminated through these discriminatory ways. That certainly has impacts on Black defendants. I was hoping you could maybe delve in a little bit. There was a case she took where she, if I get it right, she's defending members of the Ku Klux Klan.
That was the hardest part to write.
Yeah. So how is this woman who is so clearly aware of racism as it exists in Jim Crow North Carolina, she's taking on these cases where she's breaking down barriers to Black inclusion and juries, yet here she is in another breath defending members of the Ku Klux Klan.
So the Ku Klux Klan was pretty powerful in Guilford County and in central North Carolina. Like I said at the beginning, I went to high school and college in Salisbury, North Carolina, which during this time period was where the Grand Dragon of the Ku Klux Klan lived. And so it was a huge presence in central North Carolina. And they would look for Black attorneys to hire them for non-Klan related cases. So for a drunk driving case or a domestic violence case, and they would look for a Black attorney to say, "Hey, look, we can't, don't hold our Klan memberships against us. Look who we hired." And so I had a hard time. I thought it was important to include, but I had a hard time reconciling that in writing it. And I write in the introduction that, you know, often her actions are, you know, contradictory, as are all human beings. But she always said that she used it as an opportunity to educate and to hopefully pull some of these men out of the Ku Klux Klan fold. And she said she was successful. I was unable to find a lot of corroborating evidence on that.
You didn't go poll former Klan members?
I didn't go and wasn't able to find, you know, membership lists of the Klan who hired Elrita Alexander. But, you know, given who she was and her kind of force of personality, it wouldn't have shocked me at all if she was able to convince people to back away from the Klan. There are so many instances where I'm going through her oral histories. I'm like, no, that can't be. No, she didn't do that. And sure enough, of course, you know, that's the way it happened. And so, so I guess, you know, even though it was kind of hard for me in the 21st century to reconcile how somebody could do that, and still claim to be a civil rights attorney or a civil rights activist, that, you know, she used it in her own way.
Yeah. Well, I think it also is indicative of that larger idea of working within the confines that are that you have to operate within and make change how you can. I was actually reminded, I'm going to blank on his name now, but there's a guy who goes around, he's a Black guy, and he has conversations with Klan members and like befriends them and tries to get them to to back out of the Ku Klux Klan and has been incredibly successful in some respects, and just kind of meeting people one-on-one and letting them recognize the humanity of people that they may not interact with on a regular basis.
Yeah, and I think I have in the notes of the book, there is some historiography around that, mm-hmm. and people who did do that, whether they were white or black civil rights activists, but reaching out to people who were literally in terrorist organizations to, you know, recognize the humanity in other people. Yeah.
Braver than I. So as with many biographies, your examination into her personal life, I think was one of the really fascinating aspects of this. It's one thing to just kind of go through and check the boxes of, okay, the first person to do this, the first person to do that. But, and you've alluded to this a little bit already. She had a pretty turbulent, personal life, namely through, her relationship with her husband. I was hoping you could just maybe give us a little bit of insight into what her marriage was like and how it shaped her throughout her entire professional life.
Yeah, it was a rough marriage from the beginning. Mm-hmm. And again, she had a friend in college who said before they got married, just when they were dating, he was like, I don't like him. Mm-hmm. He was a volatile human being. She said he was brilliant. And I, believe that he was a surgeon. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where a lot of the connection between the two of them was in their intelligence, that they were both brilliant human beings. But he struggled with alcohol. There's evidence he struggled with mental illness. And so it ended up being a very, very violent relationship in which on several occasions, he injured her significantly in beating her. And to top it off, they had one son who suffered from, as they discovered when he was a teenager, suffered from paranoid schizophrenia. And I have two kids. They're, anytime there's a problem with your child, that's stressful on a marriage in and of itself. Yeah. And so all of these, all of these issues combined made it a really difficult situation. And as early as 1950, I cite a letter that she wrote to him saying, I would leave you tomorrow, except here are the reasons why I have not left you. And it was things like pride in my race and community and all of these things that as a black woman, she had to take into consideration more than a white woman would in that, she realized that they were not just, representing themselves or their families in their career. They were representatives of their race in Greensboro and in North Carolina.
Yeah. It's kind of that burden of being part of that talented 10th, as Du Bois said.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And there were, at the time in North Carolina, you couldn't obtain a no-fault divorce. And so it is important to point out, as soon as no-fault divorces were allowed in North Carolina in 1968, she got a divorce. but she waited until it was possible to be able to do that without a long protracted legal battle.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you kind of brought this up too, but she had one son who struggled with issues of his own and in addition to his father. But they had an interesting relationship nonetheless. She I mean, per my reading, seemed to be a very caring, loving mother who really tried to do everything she could to make sure that her son had the best possible life that he could. So could you just elaborate a little bit on what their relationship was like within the confines of that troubled marriage as well?
It was a close relationship between her and Gerardo. And because of the personal wealth that they had amassed, as an attorney, particularly her as an attorney, she was able to send him to camps. She was able to send him to boarding schools. She was able to get the best possible care that literally money could buy for him. And unfortunately, you know, the part of this story has a very sad ending. But some would say, one of her former law partners said, well, you know, she probably spoiled him too much. But, you know, she was a large part raising him mm-hmm. on her own.
Yeah.
Within the confines of, again, a troubled marriage, the civil rights movement, all of these external forces that are going on. And she was a very loving mother who did her best in really extraordinary circumstances.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So in addition to being a lawyer and dealing with her personal life, she eventually was elected to the district court. And she was the first African-American woman to be elected as a district court judge in the United States, I believe, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, again, one of these like pioneering moments. And I think in a lot of ways, it's her role as a judge that also kind of cements her legacy as one of these civil rights activists, not only because she was the first in something, but also what she did from the bench. So what was her career as a judge like, and how did she embrace this new role?
This is where, you know, that title of that chapter is called, you know, Reluctant Pioneer ? Because, you know, when she was elected, the headline in the Greensboro Daily News was a reluctant pioneer. And I could mm-hmm. kind of call BS on that she was absolutely not a reluctant pioneer. Uh-huh. She knew exactly what she was doing. She was a very politically astute person. But as she saw, you know, in the Yost case, the interracial rape case, as she saw throughout her career as an attorney, she saw, you know, disparate sentencing, particularly mm-hmm. for Black men. And so she starts something called the Judgment Day Program, which was not limited to young Black men, but it was a forerunner of juvenile deferred sentencing, where if you commit an offense, let's say it was a drunk driving offense, you go in and she would delay sentencing until you committed or, you know, community service mm-hmm. and wrote an essay and had people vouch for you. And so there are several people in Greensboro who say, I would not be where I am if Elrita Alexander hadn't taken, you know, a second chance on me. And so, of course, it was a controversial program. Mm-hmm. There are lots of issues about, you know, judicial discretion. And of course, you know, this is also a program that is targeting sentencing, particularly for young Black men.
Right.
And so it proved to be quite controversial and it was ultimately shut down. Mm-hmm. But it did, from what I've heard anecdotally, it did a lot of good while it was around.
Yeah. And it seemed, again, she was kind of operating from within those confines, but mm-hmm. coming up with really creative and in some ways beneficial ways to maybe help people change their lives and not just become part of this, like, okay, you've committed the crime, you're going to be locked up. Because this is in that moment too, where we're beginning to see, you know, the beginning of the rise of mass incarceration in the United States. And so she kind of offers a different perspective on that.
And at the time it was, you know, it was considered a really creative and unique judicial approach. Now, juvenile deferred sentencing is pretty common.
Right.
But she that's just, you know, one of those other things where she was just a bit ahead of her time.
Absolutely. So she eventually ran for the position of Chief Justice of the North Carolina Supreme Court. And there's a couple of really interesting things about this decision. One, she does it in 1974, and she decides to run as a Republican, which, if you know anything about the history of like African-American voting patterns, from the 1930s up through like 1960s, right, there's this massive switch away from the Republican Party to the Democratic Party. So she kind of bucks the trend in many ways in that regard. The race itself, for the primary race at least, is also one that would be funnier if it wasn't so sad in what it reveals about, you know, race and gender and North Carolina and the South and the United States more broadly in the 1970s. So would you just explain her decision to run as a Republican and then what the race revealed about prejudices that existed during that era?
Yeah. So she had always ran as a Republican. In 1968, she ran as a Republican. She was just running in Guilford County, though, where people knew her. So she stays with the Republican Party, and the historiography around Black Republicans, particularly at that time, you know, there's a lot of trends. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the African Americans who stayed in the Republican Party were professionally successful, had some wealth, kind of came from that, you know, Du Boisian tradition that she came from, mm-hmm. and very much had a kind of bootstraps type mentality. And so I think there were, you know, definitely appeals of the Republican Party at that time to her. Of course, between 1968 and 1974, there's a lot of transition mm-hmm. In the party. Of course, Strom Thurmond becomes a Republican in 1964. In North Carolina, Jesse Helms becomes a Republican in 1970. And so you now have a North Carolina Republican Party who's, you know, de facto leader, Jesse Helms, is one of the most outspoken racists in the country. And so the North Carolina Republican Party was not, I'd say they were beyond hesitant, just pretty flat out unwilling to provide her with any support. Mm-hmm. And so she is the first person to file, the first Republican to file in the primary, shortly after a fire extinguisher salesman with no college degree files and ultimately beats her in the primary. And the North Carolina Republican Party then had a huge conundrum on their hands because it's, you know, are we going to support?
The Supreme Court, right? Like the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court could have been a fire extinguisher. Not that there's anything wrong with fire extinguisher salesman, but this is a really important legal role.
But yes, but with absolutely no educational or legal training beyond mm-hmm. the high school level. Right. And so the North Carolina Republican Party does not outright reject James Newcomb, who ended up being the candidate. They don't really support him either. And mercifully, he did not win. Mm-hmm. Susie Sharp, who was the Democratic candidate, won. And she ends up being the first woman in the country to be an elected Chief Justice of the state Supreme mm-hmm. Court. So she's a pathbreaker in her own right. But she does, it scared her a little bit because of, you know, outside of the race dynamics, the gender dynamics mm-hmm. of that, you know, are they going to vote for James over Susie?
Right.
And so she pushes for an amendment to the North Carolina Constitution that says you at least have to have a law degree
right.
if you are going to serve as a judge in the state
probably
of North
a good
Carolina.
Idea. Probably a good idea. So what does this reveal to Elrita, who, you know, who had demonstrated that she could operate within the confines of the Jim Crow system and do so very effectively and push the boundaries of what Black people and Black women in particular were able to do? What does this loss in the primary to a fire extinguisher salesman do to her psyche, her views on herself, on the system, on North Carolina? What happens?
It hurt mm-hmm. her badly. This was the first time that she, in her professional life, that she just really kind of, that there was an obstacle that she couldn't eventually overcome. Mm-hmm. And in year, like 10 years of researching her and going through her oral histories, I learned that the things that she didn't talk about that much are the things that really, really wounded her deeply. Mm-hmm. And that race, that 1974 race, was something she did not talk about. It's not something that's included in her oral histories. She mm-hmm. just didn't talk wow. about it. And so, which is the first clue that I had that, yeah, she was really hurt by this. Mm-hmm. And I think that she had built her career, particularly in Greensboro, on she knew how to say what she needed to say to placate nervous white people. And this was the first time when she was like, she knew it was, I mean, of course she knew it was racism because she had tried cases all over the state. And so, yeah, it was a gut punch.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, despite the gut punch, she lives an extraordinary life. She eventually gets remarried, and, you know, retires from the bench. And so I just thought maybe we could leave it with this question. You know, she obviously lived a really incredible life. In many ways, she contributes to the larger civil rights movement in a number of ways, is super significant to North Carolina history and Greensboro history, and whatnot. But above and beyond just kind of reminding people that someone as important as Elrita existed, what do you hope people take away from this biography that you've written about 20th century U.S. history more broadly? Because I think in many ways, this is a book about her, obviously, but you are delving into so much more that I think is significant. So what do you hope people kind of take away after reading this?
It's a big question. well, of course, you know, I want them to know that this extraordinary woman existed.
Sure.
But also, you know, you reference at the beginning that a lot of historians end up, you know, writing about home. Mm-hmm. And that while Elrita was certainly unique and had significant firsts, you know, nationally and in the state of North Carolina, that there are women like her who did extraordinary, amazing things that have flown under the radar all over the place, particularly extraordinary, amazing Black women.
Yeah.
And so I think one of the things that I would like people to take away is that, you know, I'm a born and bred North Carolinian, and I didn't know about this woman until I was 28 years old. And so to look around, and there are really extraordinary people in all over the place, and particularly Black women who have been kind of pushed under the radar.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one of the things that struck me most about this book and her life is, you know, if you looked at her today, like if she was alive and working today, and say she defended people in the Ku Klux Klan, like she would be vilified, right? Like to no end as you know, a traitor or someone who's not really committed to the cause. And what I really appreciated about how you portrayed her life is that, you know, sometimes working within a system, as problematic as that system may be, it can have really important impacts on movement politics, on civil rights, on gender right. Like there is so much that can be accomplished from within, and you know, external pressure is certainly a positive thing too. But I was just really struck by that because I can't imagine someone like her being as accepted maybe at a time like today, where it seems like you have to have these really stark divisions. So I think you did a great job of kind of presenting that nuance of who she was, both professionally and personally, and in a way that I think we could all maybe learn a little from her own life. So thank you for doing that.
Well, thank you. I mean, we see that contrast in most social movements, you know, Martin Luther King versus Malcolm X, there's always, you know, disagreements on the best way. How do you be an activist?
Yeah.
And I think she proves that there's not one way you know, to be an activist, but also legal changes are very important to getting things done as well.
Absolutely. Well, the book is The Life of Elrita Melton Alexander, Activism Within the Courts, and it's available now through the University of Georgia Press. Virginia Summey, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you for listening to New Books in the American South.